That Podcast Thing presents Home Movie Club. Originally recorded September 2017. Episode 12, Inexplicable Accents.
Hello and welcome to Home Movie Club, the podcast in which we take an irreverent and sometimes irrelevant look at the top grossing movies of the last 80 odd years. This time we have been watching King Kong, a film from 1933 that is a large ape and a lot of semen.
Sigh.
So this is an interesting film in many ways. Obviously the special effects have dated somewhat, but it does mark several firsts for the movie industry, including the first fully scored original music by Max Steiner, much to the chagrin of the original producers, who didn't want it to happen because it thought it would cost too much.
You're getting into my fun facts there, aren't you?
I am taking your fun facts and running with them.
Fun facts.
We have been watching King Kong, and when I say we, I mean obviously myself and my fellow co-hosts. And as always, I am delighted to say I am joined by Joe Carter.
One day we will watch a film that does not have semen in.
No, we won't. Daisy Swaffer.
Kong, 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 Kong.
And Sammy Kelsch.
I am totally okay with watching films with semen in them.
We've just watched rather a lot of them in a row.
So yes, 1933's King Kong. Obviously pretty groundbreaking for its time, but did we all find the special effects exciting or just a little rubbery? Opening thoughts. So, Joe, any opening thoughts?
I'm not entirely sure what I just watched. I realised I've never actually seen a King Kong film, so this was my first exposure to that. I mean, I've seen lots of adverts and, like, recreations and spoofs and all that, but I've never actually seen a King Kong film. So I wasn't quite certain what to expect. I'm not sure that was what I was expecting. So, yeah.
No. And I think the remake that Peter Jackson did after he was given license to do whatever he wanted following Lord of the Rings, which was a mistake, again, was very similar to this, but they kind of took the premise of the Monster Island and just went for it big time. I'm not sure it worked there either. So, Daisy, opening thoughts?
Oh my God, this was amazing. This was amazing. Like, I had set expectations of, okay, so, you know, 1933 and just, I'm a bit worried. Is it going to be quite bad? It was so good. Like, this was the great granddaddy of all the monster films that I love so much. And you could see so many things in filmmaking now came from this film. And oh my God, it was so good.
Yes.
I think Daisy liked it.
I think she did as well. Sammy, what did you think?
I think my reaction falls somewhere between Daisy and Joe, in as much as I thought it was groundbreaking and the effects were fantastic and I really liked watching them. But also I did not anticipate for some reason that it was going to be as brutal as it was.
Yeah, this is rated currently as a PG, but it was.
Oh, yeah, I wasn't expecting the brutality and wow, did I love that.
Yeah. No, I haven't seen this before. I have seen the remake. I haven't seen this one. Or if I have seen this one, it wasn't ever all the way through. And yes, you can see where all the tropes of things like Jurassic World and obviously the remakes come from. This was the original. And yes, it did not mess around when it came to body counts and just brutal, brutal violence. In a PG film. And I think the reason that he got away with it was because it was black and white. I don't think you could get away with quite that much in a colour film. At least not and keep it as a PG.
Yeah, there was very little in the way of blood, despite the fact that there was a lot of just brutal mashing of people.
Yeah, there was a couple of bits where there was blood, but it wasn't a lot. And as I said, because it was black and white, it just looked like black tar, almost.
It was a bit weird.
So yes, let's get into it. It's 1933.
And you can really tell from the dialogue that it's 1933, everybody.
Yes, and obviously this film was released in 1933, so it's supposed to be set in what was then modern day. It's New York, and Carl Denham, who is played by Robert Armstrong, who I'd never heard of.
this character is like the personification of Marion C. Cooper, who was the producer and really the heart and soul and brainchild behind this whole movie. He started his career making these kind of wildlife nature type films, and this for him was how he saw his career kind of could have gone if he'd have stayed on that route and had there have been this amazing island. So I really like that there was that element of the guy who was kind of the heart and soul behind it being in it.
So Denim is literally like the self insert, basically. I like that.
Yes, Carl Denham, well known for being a wildlife picture creator, going off and filming exotic wildlife in sort of exotic locations. Not quite in the David Attenborough style, one would assume. But however, this time he has a new project to hand. And although he has managed to get together a boat and a shipload of seamen, he has yet to find a leading lady for his little venture.
He's got his gas bombs as well. Don't forget about those gas bombs.
Oh, he's got his guns and his ammo and his gas bombs. Oh, yes, he's got enough ammunition and bombs to blow up the harbour.
They mentioned the gas bombs quite a number of times to make sure we knew they had those gas bombs.
Yes, there was a certain amount of foreshadowing on the gas bombs, definitely. Yeah. Chekhov's gas bomb.
yes.
So, yes, he's trying to get hold of a leading lady for his new movie because critics have said that although his existing movies have been good, they would have done a lot better if they had... Now, I don't know if I wrote this down right, or they'd have been more popular with a flapper, which I think is just colloquial at the time for, obviously, just a pretty lady. I know from the 30s, dance styles, flappers were a thing.
Yeah, sort of a trendy young lady of that time, you know, with sort of the wavy hairdos and the little dresses and all that jazz.
Yeah, some of the language was to my ears, slightly sexist, and I'm not sure whether that's just how they spoke at that time.
I think that's probably just the way that film types would have talked about ladies at that point in time.
To quote some of the dialogue, do you think I want to haul a woman around? The public wants something pretty to look at.
Yeah,
because we're just decoration, we're just things, we're not actually people.
No, I mean, this is pre-war, so again, there wasn't that...
I'll find a girl even if I have to marry one. Yeah, it's...
Don't worry, he just kidnaps one off the street.
Yeah.
But I don't know whether that's the criticism we can lay at the door of this film or just at the time itself.
Yeah, I think it was just a sign of the times, yeah.
It's very much of its time in that respect.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yes, Carl goes wandering the streets of New York looking for a suitable girl. He goes to a looked like sort of a sort of social housing project for sort of women.
I think it was a women's shelter.
Yeah,
women's shelter. Yes, that was the word I was looking for and failed.
Bearing in mind, this is being filmed and taking place during the Depression in America. This is something that would have been, you know, fairly common, especially in big cities like New York.
Yeah. So he looks at the people. Looks at the people, the women queuing for the shelter, and decides none of them are quite what he's looking for. And goes off, carries them around, and then sees a young lady who is caught trying to steal an apple from a greengrocer.
She didn't try to steal it.
She was just
looking. All she did was put her hand on it and then pull her hand away. Yeah,
she
thought about it. Yeah. So, yes, he chances upon a starving, unemployed Anne Darrow, who is played by Faye Ray.
Mm-hmm. That would be a bit of a twist if she was playing a film star.
Anne Darrow, starring as Faye Ray, starring as Anne Darrow.
Too many layers.
Yeah. So he's taken with her because she's pretty, and that's all he's looking for.
She's very well spoken as well when he speaks to her, and she talks the talk all proper.
Which isn't an issue because these are silent movies, one would assume, but... so yes, buys her a meal, tries to convince her to join him on his little adventure, which it was really seedy. It's like, come away with me. I can provide you with fame and fortune. Just you have to come on this boat.
Yeah,
for an indeterminate amount of time to an indeterminate
basically
location.
Basically thinks that he wants to pay her for sex.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if a man approached me and bought me, you know, sort of lunch and gave that kind of an offer, I would assume that, you know, he wants me to be in like a snuff film.
Yeah, she was very much like, can you just actually clarify what it is you're wanting here?
Yeah.
Which is reasonable.
Yeah.
I'm grateful that they had that exchange.
I think the only reason she went with him is because she had heard of Carl Denham as a wildlife filmmaker. Yeah. He was famous enough for her to know that actually this guy possibly is on the level.
She knows that he's legit. Yeah.
Of course, it could have been any old bloke saying, hey, I'm Carl Denham, but, you know.
Hi, my name's Steven Spielberg. And despite the creepy element and the whole kind of, this is really dodgy, you know, it's the fact that he was entirely on the level and this is exactly what he wanted was like, oh, okay, fair enough. So, yes, they agree to go on this voyage and they all set sail on the venture.
Yay.
And travel for weeks in one direction. Towards Indonesia.
And what they didn't do was give us, you know, the next hour of them sailing, like, say, Mutiny on the Bounty.
Yeah, that was really quite good.
One of the things I really liked about this film was that they didn't really have redundant scenes in it. It was all just, you know, to the point. There was nothing in there that I would have cut out for time's sake, you know.
No, it was fairly short. It was fairly to the point.
It was very well edited. There wasn't any sort of irrelevant mush or fillers.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
Yeah,
it was very tight. For
one scene we did kind of sort of skirt around earlier was when the agent went to see Denham and tell him he couldn't get a leading lady. He spoke previously to a dockhand who had said that the ship was really overly filled with seamen. So there was more people on board than needed to be.
Three times more crew on board.
Three times more crew. Which makes me wonder whether that was just so they could, you know, up the body count later on without making it implausible that they could then sail back again.
I think that was it. And, you know, like, that many people needed to die to make room for Kong on the boat on the way back.
Well, did they not just tow him on a raft or something behind?
We'll never know, because they didn't feel the need to show us that, because it was an unnecessary information.
Which was actually quite good, because
we are grateful,
yes. We didn't need to see that.
Exactly.
Anyway, we are skipping ahead very slightly.
Spoiler, wasn't it? Oh my god, spoilers!
Spoiler. Although, this is a problem. This is a 1933 film. The main conceit was no one knew what Kong was, and now obviously in our day and age, everybody knows what Kong was.
Yeah.
So it's a little less of a shock when it's seen. Although I don't know how much of a shock it was for the actual moviegoers of the time. I'm sure the poster gave it away because there was a big ape on the front of it.
The eighth wonder of the world.
Yeah. So they're on the boat, they're travelling towards Indonesia, and then we meet up with the first mate, Jack Driscoll, who is very much against having a lady on board. Again, a sign of the times, I think. And yet, despite this, apparently is getting kind of frisky towards Anne.
Yeah, you can see very quickly why he doesn't like having a woman on board, because he finds a woman quite a big distraction.
Yeah,
and his job is to make sure the ship performs and functions properly, and having that sort of distraction on board would probably be, not great.
He's got wobbly feelings for her.
He has. But it becomes obvious that he's attracted to Anne, but Carl Denham warns him about having enough trouble without the complications of a seagoing love affair, or some such nonsense. Driscoll sneers at the suggestion and says, I'm tough, I've never been done before. Which is great, because all that does is basically give Denham the option to go through the outline of the entire film. With another rather lovely phrase, which was, the beast was tough too. He could lick the world, but then he saw beauty. She got him. He went soft. He forgot his wisdom and the little fellas licked him. There was far too much licking in this film for my liking.
That was quite a good illustration of how a lot of the dialogue in this film went.
Yes, there was another one in that scene.
It was that kind of quite stylized 1930s way that we see on the telly, which I don't know if that is how people then were actually speaking, but this was certainly a contemporary film. So,
So yes, and also Denham says about Driscoll that, well, I think I've written down as some big hard-boiled egg gets a look at a pretty face and bang, he cracks up and goes soppy or goes sappy. And it's like, oh dear, is that really how they spoke at that time?
Apparently
so. So obviously Jack's getting a bit of a feeling towards Anne.
And then do we mention
Charlie, the cook?
Yes.
Yes, we haven't mentioned Charlie. He was one of the few non non-Americans on this voyage, being a Chinaman who was acting as the ship's cook.
Yes.
As you do.
Really stereotypical, like, caricature type way.
Mm. Yeah. At least they hired a Chinese actor.
Yes, that's true.
And not just, you know, sort of a white actor with bad makeup.
Yes, that could have been a lot worse, you're right.
Oh, because I've seen that, and God, I wish I hadn't.
Yeah, and especially in black and white in the 1930s, then it is the kind of thing that I expect happened a lot then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was a little bit stereotypical, but I didn't think it was overly stereotypical, overly racist, because he wasn't demeaned in any way. He was just there. And so, yes, we get and sort of on the way through to the island, we have a scene where Carl is wanting to practice filming with Anne, which makes sense because she's never been in front of a camera before. She said she was an extra at some point earlier on, which, as some of us will attest, is probably quite hard work, dear, as being an extra in some things.
Extra-ing is fun.
Quite different to being a leading lady, I'd have thought, though.
Yes, I would say so.
Yeah.
So, yes, so he gets her to look puzzled, surprised, then look upwards, and then look more upwards, and then show terror and scream, because, you know, that's exactly what's going to happen later on.
A scream is caught in your throat, and you can't scream, but maybe if you cover your eyes, and then you can scream. It was very, yeah. I really actually enjoyed that sequence, because it was, like, all of those kind of stereotypical silent movies of the era I could see being in this, you know. It was I thought it was quite entertaining.
That was some quality emoting.
Yes. And you could see the foreshadowing of it, which, you know, I've got to love a bit of foreshadowing.
I mean, whatever happened to Fay Wray? Oh, wait, hang on.
She went on to, you know, have a continuing acting career. She was married a few times.
Good for her.
She lived to the ripe old age of 90-something, I think.
Yeah, it was in 2004 when she died, and it's said that when she passed away in her hospital bed, in the emergency room at the time, King Kong was actually on the television there.
Wow.
Okay, that's just weird.
Yeah. They didn't realise at the time. It was kind of afterwards that they found out that that had been playing in the emergency room at the same time.
So the journey continues, and they reach a certain point where Denham has agreed with the captain and the first mate that they would at this point actually tell them where they were going, which I think is probably quite a useful thing to know. And he pulls out a small hand-drawn map with some coordinates on it, so they know roughly where they need to go. He says this is never on any chart, even though he's got it on a chart in front of him. I was confused by that.
He made his own charts.
Yeah. Yes, the chart apparently drawn by a native of the island who had been rescued by, I think it was a Norwegian ship, after his canoe was swept out to sea. So yes, the map's great. It's just got three things labelled. It just says, you know, peninsula, jungle, and Skull Mountain. Because that's where you want to go, isn't it?
But you could also see where the wall was, it just wasn't labelled.
Yes, very there was also wall. The large wall, yes. Danham goes on to describe something monstrous connected with the island, and the fact that there's this big wall, and that everything is sort of cowering, or all the villagers are cowering behind the wall. And the crew scoff at this, but he does point out that most legends have some grain of truth, and then goes on to say that the thing behind the wall is called Kong.
Kong!
Which the captain admits he has actually heard of.
Gasp.
Dun, dun, dun. Although they're not sure what Kong is.
But they're like, this is in the title of this film we're in right now. It must be important.
Breaking the fourth wall.
Yes.
So they arrive in the vicinity, but there is thick fog and they can't see anything. But they can, in the distance, hear the sound of drums.
Here come the drums.
This was the first time in the film that I really started to notice the score as well. And from that point on, I was just engrossed by the musical score throughout the rest of this film. It was so atmospheric. It really put you there in every part of every moment in that movie.
Yeah, Max Glennon did a good job on this one,
which
he was his first one. So, you know, set the bar high for his first sort of film. They sort of ease their way through the fog and they come up across the peninsula on the island, and they see a village. However, there is no sign of the natives in the village. So they have a large landing party of, I think it's probably about 24 men, jump in a boat and go ashore, all with guns and smoke bombs. Make sure we've got the smoke bombs, boys.
They also made sure to bring the captain with them because he had some kind of rudimentary language skills for the general area.
Yeah,
and bizarrely, they brought Anne with them as well, because you always take your leading lady and the camera with you.
I think that was more... I think that was more Carl Dunham, to be honest. He wanted, if there was any opportunity for something to be filmed, he wanted to be able to film it.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Although you are going very much into the unknown at this point.
I don't think he's particularly concerned with his leading lady's safety.
No. So they go ashore and come across the natives who are having a ritual sacrifice of a young lady who's being sacrificed to Kong.
We never find out if she did get sacrificed or not either.
No, I don't think she did, because we'll get to it in a moment, but they were saying that the ritual had been interrupted, so it couldn't be completed.
Yeah, didn't they call it off? So
I think she got away with it.
Oh, good. Yeah. Then she ought to be, thanking them heartily, really.
Yeah, for real.
Indeed. Because she didn't look overly pleased with the idea of being...
Oh, no, she
seemed
very
a little
unhappy.
Bit anxious about it, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
All those flowers, they were not cheering her up.
No. I mean, normally, flowers.
Yeah.
I was reading through the IMDb synopsis, and at that point it says, even though they are hiding behind foliage... But at that point, they weren't hiding behind foliage. They had
the
three strands of grass they were hiding behind. And then Denham had taken the large sort of tripodded camera and stood in the open filming.
It was right in the middle of the open. It's just like, dude, you were going to get spotted. What?
And the leader was facing right towards them. So he had quite a clear view of them.
Yeah, you're going to notice, this sort of gaggle of ridiculous white people just rocking up and being like, oh, we're just going to not even surreptitiously film you doing this very important thing.
Yeah, carry on with your ritual. We'll just film over here. Don't mind us.
It kind of almost gave the thought that they were supposedly hidden, but they blatantly weren't.
No, so, they were doing a very bad job.
Yes, the chief spots
hiding.
Them and then approaches. As you said, Captain Engelhorn is able to understand their native speech and makes friendly overtures to them, trying to convince them they are friendly.
Bala! That meant friend.
Apparently so. However, another of the tribe, who is the local witch doctor, runs up and complains that because they have interrupted the ceremony, it is now they can't continue, which is why we think the young maiden is saved from a fate worse than death.
The girl is the bride of Kong.
Yes.
That is what they said, the bride of Kong.
I thought they were talking about Anna, or whatever her name was.
No, Anne, at this point they hadn't seen her, because this is at that point they go, oh look, it's a golden woman! Because, as Denham says, there's probably not many blondes around their area.
She's worth six women.
Yep, so the chief proposes swap six native women for Anna.
Pretty good deal, I think, really.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to think about it, haven't you, really?
Especially considering the actress playing Anne at that point is actually wearing a wig anyway, so,
So, yeah, obviously they offer six native ladies for Anne, however...
Which they take them up on the offer, they sail away, and that's the end of the film, yeah.
Yep, everybody lives happily after, apart from Andaro, who gets eaten by a big ape.
Which we never see. Yep.
Unfortunately, that's not what happens.
Oh, okay.
I say unfortunately, because that would make it a very short movie. So they decide not to trade Anne for some locals. And back away, going, we'll be back tomorrow to be friends. Honestly. Just walk away nonchalantly whistling.
Oh, I liked that, where he tilted his hat, put his hands in his pocket, started whistling as he walked away. It was like, they don't understand that that's, hey, I'm being casual. Like,
yeah, for we know, whistling is a declaration of war for these people, so...
But I think that was the arrogance of Carl Dunham, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Part of his character.
So they go back to the Venture, and it's night, and unexpectedly, Jack declares love for Anne.
Yeah, that moved fast.
Yeah, that was just ridiculous.
I mean, I guess there was an entire voyage that lasted a lot longer than it did on screen. So they may have spent time, sort of exchanging barbs and whatever during that period. But in terms of what we see, it feels extremely like, whoa. I did say that was quick.
This is all part of them not putting in lots of extra scenes that we don't need to move the story on. Let's assume that there were lots of extra scenes of them getting quite romantically close.
We can take it as read that they actually spent time getting to know each other as people.
And I think we can be grateful we didn't get to see that. So we can't then complain that things seem to move quite quickly. Speaking of moving quite quickly, Jack gets called off to the captain's cabin. And then suddenly some natives appear, pass their stealth check, and manage to abscond with Anne as a captive.
Oh, they did that silently. Silently. It was very impressive.
Like a ninja.
Yeah.
But then they managed to blow it all by dropping one of their blatantly, random shell bracelets on the floor.
Which they also must have done silently.
Yes. Well, I think it was given that the person who was on watch was half asleep, because we did see the watchman looking decidedly uninterested about anything.
And I'm going to assume that what they called a bracelet was actually around the ankle of the islander, so they didn't have far to fall and therefore wouldn't have made that bigger noise.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was around his wrist, because I think she sort of tore it off when she was struggling to not be abducted, but... Yes, I agree. On the other hand, it's a boat, and you've got water slapping around all outside. You've possibly got the engines running. You've got noise. It's not silent, whatever.
It was an impressive abduction, anyway.
It was.
As abductions go.
Yes, I mean, we shouldn't necessarily, promote the idea of impressive abductions, but... So they take Anne back to the island, and through the big gate... And tied up against two big posts to be presented to Kong.
That tying up equipment stuff was pretty awesome, I thought.
I wasn't sure awesome or just overly elaborate.
I thought it was really cool because they had it so that they could really tighten it up so there was no way she was getting out of there, And it was like, this is quite sophisticated stuff for not having metal with any of that, I was quite impressed.
Yeah, because I think we haven't touched on it, but I think part of the reason that we have this large wall and protecting gate and so on with what is shown as being quite a sort of not simple and not uncivilized, but not that technologically advanced islanders, I think is because they say something about it was because they had at one point been more technically advanced and they had regressed somewhat.
Yeah, there was something about that, but I don't remember.
I might have just missed that line, but that it seemed weird to me.
Yeah, I'm sure I'd seen that they said that they were a lot more advanced at one point, but had regressed due to whatever reason, and that they no longer had the ability to create the wall, but the wall was still there and they maintained it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
that sounds plausible.
Potentially because they were trapped on a small peninsula with not a lot of resources.
Yeah, that was quite a small area of an island that they were occupying.
Although we didn't see how much of it was stuff that was not in view, because you don't know, they might have had a whole fishing village over the other side of the peninsula we just didn't see.
Mm.
So, so Anne's there, trapped against these two columns, and there's a loud roar and cracking of foliage, and then... out of the jungle appears Kong.
Kong!
Who is, dun, dun, dun.
As we now all blatantly know, a large, very large gorilla.
And all the islander people were chanting, Kong, 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 Kong. And I was getting quite excited.
Aww.
I may have been chanting along with them at the time.
Aww.
So, yes, Kong appears. Back on the venture, they realise that something is afoot because they see all the torches on the island. And then they realise that Anne is missing. Charlie manages to find the bracelet and raises all hands on deck. And they grab the guns, jump in the boats and head back to the village.
There's a lot of rifles they grab there. A lot of rifles.
Well, you know, you're going to want rifles in this.
Yeah, I reckon.
But as they said, they had lots of firepower. They had lots of bombs, lots of ammunition.
Yeah, so. I was just like, whoa, when we saw the racks of rifles.
So they all go back onto the island and through the village and somehow manage to get to the gate and actually open the gate. Well, they get to the gate, look through the conveniently sized viewing slots in the gate and see that Kong has taken Anne and is going away with her. They then manage to open the gate and send half of their party through the gate and have the other half guard the gate without any of the natives actually noticing, which I thought was a bit
odd.
Well,
the natives are up on the top of the wall primarily, aren't they? So they're not really seeing what's going on at the wall when they're on top of the wall. And if I was them, I'd be looking at the gigantic gorilla taking away the woman.
True, but if I was them, I would also possibly have someone down not doing that.
What does it matter when Kong's already got the woman?
True. So, yeah, there's half of the team, half of the crew stream through the wall after Kong. The natives notice this and react, but we don't see what actually happens at that point because we keep with the crew going after Kong. Scouting party makes its way through the thick jungle following Kong's slightly subtle, huge monkey tracks. There was no way they could lose
this. They marvel at this footprint, saying that Kong must be as big as a house, but didn't they see him?
I'm not sure all of them saw him, and I don't know how well they saw him because he was off in the distance at that point.
They must have at least got an idea that he was bigger than a house.
So they travel through the jungle and they come across a Stegosaurus, which is the first of the many dinosaurs we see.
Oh my god, I had no idea that we were going to have dinosaurs, and I was so excited when we got this dinosaur.
It was amazing.
I was like, how are there dinosaurs?
I thought Kong was going to be the only big creature on this island, and then we get this dinosaur. I'm like, oh my god, so what do? They kill the dinosaur. What?
Yeah, a perfectly peaceful plant-eating animal with no real anything. But no, they kill it. They just kill it straight away. And this is a theme of this film, seems to be. So yes, they kill the Stegosaurus.
What does Carl Denham say? He goes, it would be nice to bring one of these back alive, wouldn't it? Well, maybe try not killing them then.
There's a good start. Wow.
I think we've seen
I'm assuming for
then.
All his...
This is a conservation.
I'm assuming for all his protestations,
nightmare.
He didn't actually take his camera with him at this point either. Smart. So, he could have at least taken filming of this, but no, he didn't.
Yep. Super smart. See, this is no people complain about, the young people need to get off of their phones and stuff. But can you imagine, now versus 1933, showing up on an island and holy heck, there are dinosaurs there.
Amazing.
You would get pictures of it at the very
Jurassic
least.
Jurassic Park.
Before you die.
Yeah.
But possibly not, because several of these dinosaurs were, fairly docile, plant-eating,
Yeah. Speaking of, they follow Kong and they make their way across, and they come across a big area of water, so they somehow manage to rather expertly make a really nice raft out of just some driftwood. And
I thought it was a boat.
Yeah. Well, it was almost a boat, but it was supposed to be a raft, and they were basically just upping logs and making a raft, but it was a raft big enough to hold, I think it was about, was it 12, 14, 14 people?
And it was all woven and quite well made,
Yeah, it wasn't chonky in any way, shape or form. It was a proper raft that they managed to just throw together very quickly.
Didn't last long though, did it?
No, they crossed the water and halfway through
Nessie!
They come across a territorial Apatosaurus, is what I'm calling it.
Oh my god, Nessie, what are they doing putting Nessie in this? And then when I looked into it, the first alleged sightings of Nessie went until 6 months after this film came out. This was the thing that spawned Nessie, essentially.
Oh my god.
We have impressive. Nessie because of this film, because that film is so good.
Daisy, you're blowing my mind right now.
I know, right?
Wow.
It was actually, well, what they would have called it a Brachiosaurus or a Diplodocus. Yeah. Which, as we now know, and I did question this at the time, is whether this is just artistic license or whether actually paleontology has moved forward and knowledge has increased. But this is a very much a, you know, plant-eating, docile creature.
Yes, which is that really jarred me. I was like, that's a Diplodocus. I have a furry one, a plushy one sitting on my thing from the science museum. I'm like, Diplodoci are plant-eating, like the Stegosaurus. Why the heck is it eating people?
Yes, because it does have a big bite of several of the crew, so at least two or three of the crew die at this point. And I do wonder whether that is just dramatic license, or they just didn't know that much about them at this time.
Or maybe it was self-defense.
I started trying to Google this in the course of watching the movie and realized I was missing important things in the movie to try and, you know, I was trying to fill gaps in my history of paleontology as a field of study. So
yeah, there's not a lot of time to stop and look at stuff.
Because I didn't have a chance to Google it.
There's not a lot of time to look at stuff because this film does move along at a fair clip.
I think it's fair that if there's these little things trying to kill you, you wouldn't normally eat. Now is a good time to try eating a few of them to stop them kill you.
Well, it's like, I guess the human equivalent would be, you know, like if a mosquito lands on your arm, you do that, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's not necessarily, ooh, this is something that would normally be part of my diet as a small creature. It's, you know, I feel threatened by this, therefore I'm going to attempt to defend myself.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I don't know specifically what we theorize the defense mechanisms of sort of herbivorous dinosaurs would have been.
But at this moment, our suspension of disbelief is there are dinosaurs on this island, so I think we can just go with it.
I guess.
They didn't attack. They were trying to cross the river. Dippy
attacked. This is the thing. Is actually at this point, he could have stayed under the water and they'd all been fine.
Yeah.
But maybe it got startled and that was its defense reaction.
Possibly.
Let's go with that, I guess.
I mean, if it had been a plesiosaur, the water ones, then that would have been more realistic because they at least ate fish. But that had flippers and this one didn't. It was definitely a Diplodocus or a Patasaur or whatever they're called now. But
a Patasaurus. We get a plesiosaur shortly. So up ahead in a jungle clearing, Kong places Anne on a high cleft of a tree and she has no attempt to get down and run away and goes back to confront the pursuers who have made it onto a large log crossing a ravine.
Yep.
And this is where we get quite a lot of the body count in what can only describe as a very graphic death scene.
Oh, that was intense.
Not as graphic as it was that's got cut out though.
Really?
Yeah.
Did they cut stuff out because graphic? Oh, yikes.
Because this was a scene where, just to describe it for the listeners, we have 12 people on a big log over a very deep ravine.
Fewer than 12 because some people got eaten by Dippy.
Okay, maybe 8
to 10. Oh, Dippy.
Depending on current life levels.
Well, it's not Nessie, so I'm calling it Dippy. Yeah.
And Kong grabs one end of the log and shakes it and rolls it, and basically these people plummet, you know, several meters to their deaths. There's lots of screams and then sort of clutches as it lands on the ground. And because it's done with sort of animated marionettes, it just looks brutal.
What was cut out there is that where they plummeted down to, they were still alive and some gigantic spiders came and ate them alive.
Okay.
I'm glad that was cut out.
So that got cut out. we missed that bit, unfortunately.
Fortunately, no un about it.
So the only two who survive... Spiders. No. The only two who survive this attack on the ravine are the two main named characters, oddly enough. So Driscoll and Denham, although they are separated with Denham on the other side of the ravine and Driscoll
Hang
on the
side. Hang on a minute. Side. You've got to have Denham playing blinking patty cake with King Kong. Otherwise, you know, the bit of levity in there, that was just funny.
I don't think it was meant to be funny. Oh. But yes, we had a situation where Driscoll was hiding in a cave and
Driscoll,
King Kong
sorry,
was...
not Denham, yeah.
Yeah, oh, thank Driscoll's you.
I'm confused.
Cave
I thought I'd missed something.
No, I got the wrong...
Different D-dude.
They do look the same.
White people. Go on.
And Kong is reaching into the cave and Driscoll is stabbing at him with his small blade. So his knife, I think it is. And then we get a random two-armed, no-legged, apparently, dinosaur climbing up.
So
to attack. I don't know what that was.
Fun fact, that was meant to be a four-legged creature, which I did read the name of and can't remember because I don't remember dinosaur names. But you need more budget for more limbs, so they cut the budget, and cutting the budget meant it didn't get two of its limbs, so that's why it only has two legs instead of four.
All right.
It looks... For a film of slightly dodgy techniques and slightly dodgy of its age special effects, it looked terrible. And it didn't last very long because it was climbing up a rope that Driscoll just chopped with his blade and it fell to its doom. Probably landed on top of some of the other corpses below.
And it probably got eaten by giant spiders.
Probably got eaten by giant spiders as well, yes. It couldn't run away because it only had two legs. Dragging its backside on the ground. So yes, we have a situation where Driscoll is on the same side as Kong, but Denham is on the other side. So he gets sent back to get help and grab more of these. I think we've heard of them before. They're called gas bombs.
Gas bombs!
They have mentioned them once or twice.
Yay!
Yeah, apparently.
If only they told us that they were bringing those along and then it wouldn't have come out of the blue like that.
Yeah,
oh,
so
wait.
He went to grab gas bombs to subdue the creature. Randomly, and this is a part of the film I've never quite understood, Kong has become smitten with Anne.
I think he sees her as a toy.
Yeah, I don't know. It's almost seems like it's supposed to be that he falls in love with her beauty, but, you know, they're different species. That's just a bit weird.
Yeah, I think he just sees her as a favourite toy.
Yeah, I don't think it's a romantical thing. I think it's more of a sort of... I don't know. There's probably some weird symbolism in there, but you know, sort of functionally on a this level, it feels more like a, you know, sort of, oh, it's pretty, like you would with if you had, you know, sort of a I don't know, a gerbil.
Well, I have, you know, like favorite toys that I would fight people over if they tried to get near. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I am looking at an entire sort of, you know, like windowsill full of very precious Disney Infinity figurines, pop vinyls, and a couple of Legos. So I feel you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have a situation where actually we've kind of skipped forward slightly because we still have Kong trying to grab Driscoll whilst Anne is sitting in this tree and suddenly a T-Rex appears.
Oh, this moment was so good.
Or at least the 1930s equivalent of a T-Rex.
Really? Good.
I don't know if I hope I'm not skipping ahead if I just mention the bit that I love is where it takes its tiny little arms and kind of scratches its face.
Yep, that's what it turns up, it looks around, it sort of scratches itself and then sees Anne and moves towards her. Anne obviously screams because, well, she's been practicing that earlier. Which alerts Kong, and Kong rushes back and starts a titanic fight with the T-Rex.
So the choreography of this fight, which was amazing, was Marion C. Cooper, the brainchild of it behind, I was mentioning before, used to do wrestling, and someone else who was working on it, I can't remember the name of. So they actually, between them, worked out, like, wrestling moves, what this whole fight sequence was going to be. And then the stop-motion animators created that. And that's why it looks like a proper awesome scrap. It's so well done. I was just, like, cheering at the television for this.
I was not cheering because I did not want the dinosaur to suffer. Because it's just doing as nature intended by, you know, being a carnivorous creature. And also it's super cute with its tiny little arms, and I'm extremely sensitive to any sort of creatures getting hurt.
It was a brutal finish as well.
I know.
Yeah,
I
so it
cry.
Ends with Kong basically breaking the jaw of the dinosaur, which doesn't kill it outright, so we have a scene.
It's going to slowly starve to death instead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
it was brutal.
Kong dispatches the T-Rex and then takes Anne to his mountain lair. Driscoll following comes across the T-Rex. And this is one point where we do see blood, because blood is basically bubbling out of the mouth of the T-Rex as it slowly dies. Not pleasant, but there you go.
So good. I'm not bloodthirsty, honest. I like it in fiction, not real life.
Yes, so they go into this mountain lair, and then we get a plesiosaur. Hurrah for random dinosaurs who attack things for no apparent reason. I mean, this is supposed to be a wild and savage land, but you can't walk 10 paces without being attacked by something else. So how anything survives in this place is beyond me.
I think they probably mostly usually ignore each other. It's just that in this case, Kong's got a new toy and they want to play.
Are they just squabbling children? Yeah. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah. I thought this was a giant snake.
Yeah, it was a giant. It's basically a giant snake with little flippers. It's a plesiosaur, so it is a just a ocean-going dinosaur that ate fish and things.
Yeah, I thought it was a snake at first, so I was surprised when I then saw its little flipper thing.
Yeah, I mean, I saw flippers, but I thought plesiosaurs were more like, you know, brontosauruses with flippers, not snakes with flippers. But then that's probably
yeah,
just
again,
from
it's
cartoons.
It's a 1930s style dinosaur, I think.
Sorry, I keep forgetting.
Or at least a representation of. Because obviously we also have a situation where it comes out of the water and starts strangling Kong. And I'm not sure waterbound dinosaurs could. I don't know, were they amphibious? I guess they may have been.
Who cares?
I was going to say the answer there is a resounding maybe.
It was a totally different kind of fight as a result of this such a different kind of creature. And so Kong had to employ totally different tactics. And I was a bit worried for him there. And oh God, it was so good. Like, I was so lost in these fight sequences that I didn't see the, you know, the stop motion effects when we're so used to CGI now. I was there, I was watching, it was real, you know, it was so well done.
But yep, Kong beats him by taking his tail and swacking him around on the rocks until he dies. Kong goes back to Anne and inspects his prize, randomly tearing off bits of her clothing and tickling her.
Yeah, I
didn't
what was going
quite
on?
Quite get
here?
That either.
The orchestral sound effects with the tickling was great.
The music in this sequence is so perfect.
I mean, we've got like a good big chunk of, like, I don't know, 10, 20 minutes or something in the film where there's no dialogue at all. All we're getting is the orchestral score and some sound effects. It's so well done that you just don't realise it.
I mean, I'm not sure why the there was this scene where he was tearing her clothes off. It was odd in context. It made sense out of context.
It was disturbing. I didn't like it. And
it was disturbing.
That whole thing does give sort of an odd, sort of uncomfortably sort of sexual undertone to
his
sort of fascination.
Which
is
very unnecessary.
To me, he was playing with his new toy, and it's like when you've got a doll and you see what bits move and what bits don't and what bits come off and what bits stay on.
I mean, also it's the fact that it's a lot easier.
As a child, right, Dace?
It's a lot easier to animate something if it doesn't have lots of diaphanous robes.
Yes.
He's right. There's a real practical sort of implication going on behind the scenes, but from that perspective, it was very.
It was uncomfortable, and I don't know what the initial intention behind it was, but it did not come across.
Yeah, even I wrote very odd about that bit of my notes as we went through.
Yeah.
Even me, who is enjoying every moment of this film, wrote that was very odd.
Yeah.
The pterodactyl next.
Oh my god, I really wish the dinosaurs would stop trying to abduct Anne.
Oh, they were
so amazing! It got very old.
Oh, I really did. Yeah. I wanted more of them. It was so good.
So yes, he leaves Well, you think he'd learn, but he once again leaves Anne and goes off to do something else, and in doing so...
Well, no, that's because he hears Driscoll climbing and he knocks the rock. That's why he goes to investigate.
We have the treacherous rock scene where a big rock falls over because Driscoll's an idiot. And yes, so he goes to investigate and he turns his back for 30 seconds and a large pterodactyl comes and again tries to abduct Anne, which I guess for the dinosaurs, this is quite a small, probably quite convenient prey size. So, you know, these are not abducting per se. These are basically going to eat.
Yeah.
This is just food.
And this is a flying dinosaur now. This is a totally different kind of fight again for Kong, and it's so good.
But it was just, yeah, I mean, there was never any doubt that he would win. This is the problem.
Well, that's only because you know, like, what happened.
True. Also, he is the title character, so. Kong is distracted, so Jack manages to finally rescue Anne by... They climb down... This just struck me. There was a long ravine down to some water below. They had a vine that was apparently just the right length. He waggled the vine at the top, but didn't actually check whether it was attached or anything. And then they both jumped on it, and they both rappelled down the vine. That was a bit weird. And then Kong gets back, realising that Anne has gone, and... notices the vine wiggling. I assume it's the only reason I can think of he knows it's there, and starts to pull the vine back up again. And to avoid this fate, they both let go and plummet to their certain death below.
But it's okay, they land in water.
Yay!
Which obviously, you know, you do without any kind of injury because, you know, that's how water works.
Suspend your disbelief.
Okay. So yes, they escape. Somehow managed to get back to the wall without being killed by any of the other myriad dinosaurs. Or perhaps there were no other dinosaurs. Perhaps every single dinosaur had been killed by Kong at this point.
Or by the guys with the guns.
And he had managed to somehow depopulate the entire island in the space of about 40 minutes. Who knows? So they make it back to the wall, but Kong is chasing them. They try and close the gate, and the natives actually come and help because, I don't know, suddenly they're back interested in it and they need extra bodies to be killed.
Well, they don't want Kong trampling their huts, does it, do they?
No. But the thing that got me is this was blatantly, obviously, all the fault of the visiting sort of...
Idiots.
Party,
yeah.
All the seamen. Why didn't they do something to get rid of them? It just seemed a bit kind of...
They
going to hide enough.
That they tried to attack. The natives tried to attack, and they shot over their heads, and then they just ran away.
Yeah, it was overly convenient, if you ask me.
Yeah,
yeah. I'm guessing limited budget would be the answer, but
Yeah, true.
There's a lot to take up budget in this picture. Let's be real.
Yeah. So Kong is on a rampage. We have more deaths of both natives and the crew of the Venture until they finally make it to the beach line where Denham gets to his big box of gas bombs and, yay, he throws a gas bomb and Kong falls asleep.
And it knocks out this gigantic creature, but all of the tiny little people nearby... aren't affected at all. It's a gas bomb of convenience.
So realistic.
Honestly.
Yeah.
It wasn't even like the wind was blowing away from them or anything. That gas was hanging around.
Yeah.
Yep, completely unaffected by it.
Is it just some kind of magical gas bomb that there's no way that existed that just for some reason humans are immune to it, but like other primates, you know, will just... Yep. Knock them right out, no matter how implausibly huge they may be. But it has no effect on normal people.
Yep.
Yeah.
Realistic.
It was...
totally realistic, y'all.
I hadn't picked up on this during, but yes, you're right.
Me neither. I was
laughing quite a lot at that bit.
It's one of those things where if you don't notice at the time, and I didn't, it's. You know, later on, you get up, you go to make a cup of tea or something before bed, and you're like, wait a minute.
Yeah. So yes, we have the crew wanting to either run away or kill Kong, but Denham convinces them that if they take it back to New York, they can chain it to a raft and tow it behind the boat. Not sure what it's going to eat in that journey, but let's not dwell on that.
We don't need to know the ins and outs of that journey.
He was the king of his world, but we can make him fear ours, and we can make ourselves millionaires.
This is the best idea person has ever had. Yeah. The best.
In a few months, his name will be up in lights on Broadway. Kong, the eighth wonder of the world.
And then next scene, Kong, the eighth wonder of the world. His name up in lights.
That was perfect. Yeah.
Brilliant. I love that they didn't make us sit through another boring voyage.
Yeah, no weird, what they did with him in the meantime.
Because we don't know we don't need to know what happens between he's gassed, they take him back, boom, now he's a
they we keep never gassing see him any on the boat, which is fine because none of the crew are affected by this gas.
We never see any of the crew again, so perhaps they were fed one at a time to Kong to keep him alive.
Oh yeah. Oh, I like that.
Oh, that's horrible.
Possibly. They had a lot of crew, so yeah.
Yeah, they had more crew than they needed, perhaps just to allow body count and fare.
Yep.
So yes, they're in a big New York theater. We have the three main characters dressed in evening wear.
So the theater goers there, the people going to see it, are paid like $10 a ticket in the Depression in the 1930s. This is an immense amount of money. And they seem to really understand what it is that they're actually going to see.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, they're going to see this Carl Denham, and they think he's going to see another wildlife film.
Mm. But they paid a lot they said of money originally, for just seeing a film.
Yeah.
They said originally that his films could have made a lot more money if they had a dame in it, or a flapper, I think it was. But that's kind of like, so he's not that popular then.
Yeah.
So why are they doing this to go to this? I mean, even if you get word of mouth that this is the best thing you've ever seen.
I think he must have got some really awesome marketing bods on this one.
Yeah. Amazing PR.
Yeah.
So we have a theater full of New Yorkers. There is a comment that this thing is a giant gorilla, just as someone pushes over someone else sitting in one of the rows of the seats, with the lady commenting that they have enough gorillas in New York already.
That, I thought that was quite amusing. Lady was my favorite character in the entire film. She was amazing and I love her.
Before that, Dunham says that they've taken $10,000 at the box office in this one night. $10,000 in the 1930s Great Depression. Can you imagine?
So 10,000.
That is a very tidy sum of money.
Yeah.
That's 1,000 people, surely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That theatre was not holding 1,000 people.
Well, I'm just going by what Dunham said.
Oh, no, I agree entirely.
He may have been
unless they had extortionate booking fees.
Well, you know, that the guy outside who said these tickets cost me 20 bucks, maybe he was in the cheap seats.
And maybe that was each. Who knows?
Yeah.
So, yes, they have Dunham come on and he explains what they're about to see is the eighth wonder of the world, and the curtain rises and you have Kong chained up, and I made in my notes, well, this can't possibly go wrong.
Oh, hang on, you missed the bit backstage where he's basically convinced Anne and Driscoll to come back and bribe them with clothes and promises of money, and made them basically relive the horrific experience, the trauma that they went through.
And they're getting married the next day.
I was a little bit wary of this whole, okay, now you have to be on stage with this thing that, like, you're going to have PTSD flashbacks about that experience the rest
was
of your
terrified.
Life.
I mean, this was horrific of him.
I think we can all agree that Dunham is not really a people person.
He has a very cavalier attitude to a lot of things that I think should be given more sensitive consideration.
Yes.
Yeah, so we do have a situation where the press are also be at backstage and they want to take photos, but he says, no, wait until everybody's on stage so we can take photos whilst on stage.
Yeah.
Kong is revealed. He introduces Anne and Jack. They have a slightly kind of inconvenient, not inconvenient, slightly uncomfortable walk onto stage, and then they bring the press up to take photos of Anne and Jack and of Kong.
But don't worry, Kong is in chrome steel chains, so it's
so can't possibly escape.
Nothing to worry about. Chrome steel chains.
That nobody anticipated the myriad ways in which this setup could possibly go wrong. I mean, it's a mix of hubris and stupidity.
Yeah.
I think it's mainly stupidity.
Yeah.
It's Carl Dunham's arrogance again. Yeah. We see a lot of arrogance from him, and he's convinced that he's kind of he's ruling this animal now, really. He's conquered it. And so he can't possibly break free of these chains.
He honestly
believes what he's saying himself, that, well, these are chrome steel chains, so he can't possibly break free of them.
Oh, he wouldn't do it if he didn't believe it. He's just an idiot.
So the press come on and they start taking photos with their old-style large flash bulbs. It's conveyed that Kong thinks this is actually either being attacked or someone's attacking Anne.
Yeah, strange.
In fact, I think even Carl shouts out, "Stop, stop," because Kong thinks they're attacking Anne. But the press keep taking photos.
Strangely enough, a sequence of like bright flash bulbs startles a wild animal. How did you not anticipate
that? That is entirely unpredictable. I don't know how they could possibly have thought that would happen.
It's absolutely ludicrous. I mean, this is the person who supposedly makes films of wild animals. He should have...
He doesn't use a flash, though, does he? Doesn't use a flash.
No, exactly.
And to be fair, he also doesn't really care about the animals themselves.
God.
Yeah, he has said in previous scenes that, you know, he was filming a rhino, and if the rhino charged, he would just shoot the rhino. So he's not exactly in it for the animals,
he's in it for himself.
No,
for the money. And the fame.
He's never heard of scruples.
No.
So the flashy lights startle Kong, who, oh no, breaks out of his chains.
Oh, shocking.
Chrome steel chains.
Manages to break.
But you know what was really weird here? It wasn't that he broke his chains. That was predictable. It's that he then bent down and undid them.
Yes, he took off the belt that
I
was restraining his...
I think he pulled the belt apart and
No, his legs. He undid the chains around his legs.
Well, we saw he was quite dexterous when he unwound the restraints for when Anne was being held at the... sacrificial altar.
It was mind-boggling. It was like this guy, he broke his arms free, and then it was just, I suppose it was a show of intelligence, to be fair.
I mean if
you look at the manual dexterity of actual, you know, sort of primates and the way that they handle things and can learn to use objects as tools and that kind of thing. They're very smart and they're very good with their hands.
He's not a creature of pure aggression. He's a gentle creature.
He does actually have an intelligence.
Yeah.
But I thought that was a really good way of showing it, was basically where I was going with that.
Yeah.
I thought that was really...
Yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
I agree.
However, this is King Kong, so he is going to go on a rampage. So he breaks out of the cinema and begins rampaging through New York.
Eating people.
So he first climbs up the side of the theatre and looks through a window and sees a lady in her bed and picks her out and looks at her and, realising it's not Anne, just discards her and throws her to her death.
He just drops her.
That was awesome.
That was horrible.
That was so good.
I mean, you know, he doesn't care, so that's fair enough. But yes, no,
it was brutal. I loved it.
Well, I think it's
so he keeps climbing.
He's huge. He sees people in the same way that we see probably like mayflies.
It was a toy soldier, you know? This isn't my toy soldier drop.
So he manages to climb, and then actually, in a somewhat amusing scene, we have Jack and Anne in the hotel room, and Jack's going, "Oh, it'll be fine. Everything's all right now. Everything's fine." Just as Kong sticks his head up into the window, and you see Kong's eyes look through the window and into the hotel room. And it was at this point that Kong struck me as being pure Wallace and Gromit, which took me out of it very slightly.
Oh, dear.
The design and style of the Kong model just reminded me an awful lot of the early stuff that Aardman did. Not Wallace and Gromit, actually before that, which they did for the Creature Comforts, I think it was called.
Yeah. Well, that's the one where they did basically sort of like, they just got sort of, you know, like, clips of just people talking about stuff and then put it over
they interviewed everyday people talking about very boring mundane
and
things
and then made them cats and dogs and mice
and then made them cats and dogs and actually gorillas as well, and that's it just reminded me of that, and it just took me out of the film slightly.
I think fairness, though, I think perhaps that King Kong was first.
Yes,
so
no,
maybe
I agree. I'm
it
not
was
saying
the
Aardman
was reflective of King Kong rather than the other way around.
Yes, no, I think that's fair, but I'm more familiar with Aardman than I am with King Kong, and that's, I think, where that went. So, yes, he looks in, he sees Anne again, tries to reach her through the window. Jack attacks him with a chair, manages to break the chair ineffectively over his over Kong's hand, and then gets flicked across the room and just becomes unconscious, or at least gets knocked back.
He gets stunned, I think.
Yeah. Kong reaches in and grabs Anne and confirms it's the right one this time, and then continues climbing the building.
Well, he has a look down first and sees that the streets are pretty full at the moment, so keep going up.
Keep going up, go to the higher ground.
But then he reaches
the
roof.
Yep, he reaches the roof and looks around and try and works out where he's going, then continues down the other side of the building.
Yeah, then I feel like he was a bit bored of the roof, so he decided to go and see what else there was.
I mean, the ultimate end of this is he climbs up the Empire State Building, but actually you see the Empire State Building in the background and he's definitely going away from it at this point.
I didn't notice that.
Yeah. So he climbs down. Just as he's climbing down, Jack and Denham reach the roof and see him drop down. So they try and work out what to do. Kong then rampages through the streets of New York, attacks an elevated car, killing more people.
Fun fact, that elevated car scene was there because Marion C. Cooper grew up near an elevated train line. So he really wanted to have an elevated train car sequence in there. But it hadn't been, they hadn't made it in, and the film was 13 reels long, and I think it was the picture house, whatever you call them, RKO, didn't like, they were a bit superstitious and didn't like that it was 13 reels long, and asked him to add some more footage in to make it 14 reels. So he's like, brilliant.
Wow.
Elevated car sequence it is then.
Hey!
I did think that elevated car driver wasn't doing his job very well, because it was fairly obvious the track wasn't there, yet he didn't actually put the brakes on until he saw the large ape stick his head through the hole where the train used to be.
The bit in my notes here for this bit says, squash, screaming, death.
Yeah. Again, mate, you never want to go on an elevated car ever again.
It was awesome.
So Kong finally makes his way to the Empire State Building and starts climbing it. We hear about this because of a news report or a police report that Denham and Driscoll hear whilst in the local police station. They are of the impression that if he climbs the Empire State Building, nothing can touch him. What would they ever do?
If only they had something that could go as high as a building.
Only if there's something that could fly.
Of sending an aeroplane after them. So yes, the military dispatches four biplanes, which apparently
are biplanes. It was adorable.
Curtis Hell divers, apparently, according to research, who go up, take off from an airfield the other side of the island. I don't quite know where that's supposed to be, but it was within sight of New York and within sight of the Empire State Building. So
at this point, I was a bit confused about what they were going to do, because Kong had Anne in his hand. So if they are successful at shooting Kong, then, you know, Anne's fate will be the same as Kong's. So I was a bit like, really? You sure you want to send aeroplanes up there?
Although they did then, they did fly towards Kong and realize that Anne had been, was being held. So they did hold off their attack.
Yeah.
But then Kong makes the slightly fatal mistake of gently setting Anne down on the building's observation deck.
So he can have a good swipe at these pesky little flies that are going around and
so whilst he's on top of the building in a very iconic scene, the biplanes attack, shooting at him with machine guns. One of them is swatted out of the sky, which again confused me very slightly, because I see no reason why they need to get anywhere near that close to him, because bullets travel slightly further than that.
Because artistic license.
And it was awesome!
Yes, I guess. So he swats one of the planes out of the sky, but the other three continue firing on him until...
And we got a great view with the plane as well. We went down the building, like, from the plane's view. It was really well done.
Yeah, some of the aerial stuff in this was quite good. Some of it was a bit questionable. Some of the manoeuvres they were pulling off. But yes, no, some of it was quite good. And then eventually enough bullets managed to hit Kong that he falls from the building, smashes his way down the side and lands on the sidewalk below.
But luckily he'd already put Anne down, so she was fine.
I like to think he was just knocked out from that.
A few seconds later, conveniently, just as Kong falls, Driscoll manages to make his way to the top of the building, climbs out and rescues Anne from the observation deck. Meanwhile, we see crowds gathering around the now lifeless corpse of Kong, who is less pavement pizza than you'd possibly expect, considering the fall. And Denham makes his way through, and he's let through by the police because he says he's Carl Denham and isn't arrested on site for releasing a wild animal on New York and killing lots of people.
He would be arrested because he's the one that caused all this havoc and deaths and stuff.
There doesn't seem to be any real consequences to his actions, does there?
No, it's odd.
Yeah, so he comes back with the policeman says, "Well, Denham, the airplane's got him." And he comes back with the rather terrible line of, "It wasn't the airplanes, it was beauty that killed the beast."
I don't know what the insistence on beauty and the beast throughout this was. It was just, that was
awkward. Well, that was the story he was trying to tell with the film he was intending to make. So he kind of got fixated on that, and somehow in his head, then that was the end result, no?
Yeah, so beauty killed the beast. And we get the closing end credit of the end,
and
that's it.
And that's it.
Boom.
And then it's over.
Yeah, again, another movie of the 30s where they front-loaded all of the credits.
That's just the way they did stuff back then.
So the ending is just the end. We had a brief recap of who played whom, and that was it.
Yep.
End of film.
So, fun fact, after Faye Ray had finished doing her scenes for the film, she actually went to a sound studio, spent a day there recording screams all day, screams. And she named this her Aria of the Agonies.
That must have been really quite terrible on her
voice.
Yes, it
must have. Yeah,
that would have been terrible.
But I can see why she did that after filming everything else.
Yes, Aria of the Agonies.
I think that's fairly standard procedure for most sort of voice work these days, is you do everything and then at the end you do the required grunts and screams and sort of anything that would damage the vocals.
Speaking of grunts and screams, Kong's roar was created by mixing together a lion's roar and a tiger's roar and then running that backwards slowly.
Impressive.
And we didn't get a Wilhelm scream.
No Wilhelm, because this Wilhelm was around then.
Oh, don't forget
this
the death
is pre
count.
Wilhelm scream.
Death count 40.
Yes, yeah, so the death count of 40. So that's 12 of the crew of the venture, several unnamed natives, and
a
I guess
lot of people on
people
the streets
in the cars,
of New York.
Yeah. People in the streets. So 40, which
mostly gruesome. Pretty brutal ones.
That it was quite low count, but quite high brutality. That was kind of, it wasn't what I was expecting for what is now rated a PG.
Yeah, I had to go and check what the rating was when these brutal scenes started, because I was like, whoa, I thought this was going to be a lot more PG. It is PG.
But I wonder if they got away with it because the deaths and all of the sort of all of the people dropped or bitten were fairly obviously not real people. There wasn't any real blood. With that death count, are we including animals or
no.
not?
No. Dinosaurs and Kong and stuff.
No.
No, because we don't.
Interestingly, in terms of the ratings, there was actually in America, they put in this whole load of restrictions and regulations and ratings the very next year. And I think quite possibly that was because of this film.
Nice.
Yeah. So. I'm not surprised. I'm surprised it's PG. I suspect the only reason it is a PG is because of its age, and the impact of the deaths is less because of the special effects and the style of the time.
Black and white.
And the fact it's black and white, and the blood seeping out of the T-Rex's mouth just looks black. And yeah, it does not have the same impact as it would if it was full colour and, you know, CGI and directed by Peter Jackson.
Haven't seen it.
Stick with this one.
Wasn't planning to.
Yeah.
This one is 110 minutes and moves very quickly and is good. I believe the King Kong, even on the theatrical release, the Peter Jackson version, is nearer 3 hours, if not more than 3 hours.
Peter Jackson seems to have a thing for doing very long movies, doesn't he?
Yeah. As I said, the King Kong was the film he did after he did the Lords of the Rings trilogy.
Yeah.
So he pretty much had carte blanche to do whatever he wanted.
So they approached Fay Wray to do a cameo, and she politely declined.
Yay!
Good for her.
I approve.
Yeah. So yes, that was King Kong in all of its glorious stop motion, brutal glory.
Cinematic, defining. Just there's so much of it. Now
cheesy.
You can see in where cinema has gone from there. This started so much, you know? Oh god.
Yeah. Everything from the music to the editing to just the whole monster
the tension
movie.
And build-up, you know, it's a long way into the film before we see Kong and we get this build-up and anticipation as we go through it. And that wasn't normal in filmmaking then.
No. I actually really enjoyed it. It wasn't perfect, obviously, and some of the lack of perfection was due to the age of it. And some of the special effects didn't necessarily, even when looked against other stop-motion. But again, it's of its age. It's pre-war, and we have to appreciate that. I mean, we're not talking Harryhausen, but then equally, we're not talking 60s when Harryhausen was making his films. So.
Exactly. Harryhausen is one of those people you can say was born of this film.
Yeah, absolutely.
We wouldn't have had our Harryhausen stuff if we hadn't have had King Kong first.
And Harryhausen is my dude. So I'm grateful.
Historically, this is a very important film, definitely. Yep.
And following on from Harryhausen, we had Phil Tippett. So,
yep.
All mm-hmm. of this, the several generations of amazing stop-motion creations on film has come from this, from King Kong, and its amazing success and just cinematic creation of amazingness. I love this film so much. I had no idea how much I was going to love this.
Phil Tippett, obviously, for those who don't know, is responsible for an awful lot of the stop motion in the original Star Wars films. And so,
Jurassic Park,
Jurassic
RoboCop,
Park, he went on to do that.
Yeah, umpteen things.
Good stuff.
Yeah. So, yes, that was King Kong. I'm going to ask for closing thoughts. I suspect we know what daisies are going to be. but, yes, Joe, any closing thoughts?
I'm not totally sure. I mean, I was very confused why there was dinosaurs. I can understand that for 1933, the stop motion was brilliant, but it just seemed kind of cheesy.
Daisy, I know you didn't overly enjoy this film, so any last thoughts on you?
I was actually, I thought the misogyny in this would be a lot worse, so I was actually relieved that wasn't as bad as I feared it would be. And I think you might have been able to tell that I really loved this movie. Oh my god, I'm so glad we've done this podcast so that I've actually sat and watched this film, you know. Wow, thank you for the whole idea for this moment. Great.
Well, make up for the fact that next time around it's Titanic, so.
Yeah.
Sammy, your last thoughts?
I really thought that the effects in this movie were so wonderfully done. I thought they were really cool, and I enjoyed watching them. I really enjoyed how very 1930s a lot of the, the dialogue and the characters were in this movie, even if some of their attitudes seemed a little bit antiquated. But I did not, when I decided that, yes, I'm going to be, watching this movie with you because it's part of the podcast and it's my job, I did not anticipate that there would be a massive, super long sequence, which, while incredibly beautifully executed in terms of the effects and stuff, was essentially watching a whole bunch of dinosaurs die. And I'm not good with films where you see animals suffering. Even when it's like stop motion special effect, not real animals, it was really brutal.
Final thoughts, Dave?
I enjoyed it. I can understand its importance historically for film, and it was an enjoyable adventure film. It was nicely short. It didn't have much in the way of padding. The special effects were, for their time, great, but looking at that from a sort of 21st century eye, were a little bit chonky. But no, I enjoyed it. I wouldn't necessarily rush back to watch it again, and it was a lot more brutal in the way that lots of animals and humans died. I wasn't expecting that. And it was a little bit shocking. But no, I think I enjoyed it overall. So yeah, but again, I wouldn't rush back to watch it again, and I certainly wouldn't rush to watch the Peter Jackson version.
Yeah, me either. I will give it that it was a really nice length. It wasn't too long, and I didn't... Well, okay, at the very end, I was nearly falling asleep, and then I had a nap. But, you know, it wasn't too bad.
I haven't seen it, but by all accounts, don't bother with the sequel Son of Kong, which also came out in 1933.
Well, how about that? I didn't even know it was a thing.
I think that was very much more just exploiting the sort of first one.
Oh, any more random facts before we go, Dave?
It was about the sets, really, because, you know, so much of the budget for this film obviously went on that incredible stop motion. So they saved money elsewhere. That native village was a leftover set from RKO, which is the, you know, the production company. Their 1932 film Birds of Paradise, that wall that you can see, you know, the one that Kong came through, that was from the Temple of Jerusalem set for the biblical epic The King of Kings in 1927.
Right.
As you're saying that, they did actually say in the film itself that it looked like it almost could be Egyptian.
Yeah,
so they were almost self-referential at that point.
Same wall got reused a few times because it was a good wall.
So and it was probably expensive piece of set to build as well, so they wanted to get the most out of it, for sure.
They used it for the Garden of Allah in 1936, and it got pulled down by a tractor when it was redressed as Civil War era building fronts during the burning of Atlanta in Gone with the Wind, 1939.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Okay, well, that was King Kong, and we will leave it at that. Next time, we have more semen! Hurrah!
Oh, God.
Because we have James Cameron's 1997 epic, Titanic.
Right.
I have a sinking feeling about this one.
Oh!
So, yes, thank you for listening. Thank you to my co-host. Thank you to Joe.
Thank you, Dave.
And thank you to Daisy.
Kong!
And thank you to Sammy.
Thank you.
And thank you for me. Thank you for listening. And goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Home Movie Club, part of the That Podcast Thing network. Find us on Twitter at @podcast_thing and on Facebook by searching for That Podcast Thing. Please like and subscribe for news of our future episodes coming soon.